This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Reynolds Price, the acclaimed writer known for his evocative novels and stories about rural North Carolina, died in Durham yesterday. He was 77. The cause was complications from a heart attack. Price had been a paraplegic for more than 30 years due to spinal cancer, but he continued to write novels, essays, short stories, memoirs, and translations from the Bible. Price was recognized as a remarkable talent with the publication of his first novel, A Long and Happy Life, in 1962. In his New York Times obituary, novelist Alan Gurganus called Price the best young writer this country has ever produced. He started out with a voice, a lyric gift, and a sense of humor, Gurganus says, and an insight about how people lived and what they'll do to get along. Except for his years as a Rhodes Scholar in England, Price spent his life in North Carolina, teaching at Duke University, writing, and inspiring a new generation of Southern authors. Terry spoke to Reynolds Price several times over the years. Today we'll listen to portions of two of those conversations. They first spoke in 1989, when Price had written Clear Pictures, First Loves, First Guides, a memoir of his early life. In the introduction, he says, childhood memories opened up to him after he underwent hypnosis for pain relief.
You were getting flooded with memories.
Sort of parallel occurrence and a parallel delight was that as I worked more at home and away from the therapist, first working with a cassette recording of his voice, and then with my own concentration, I just began to find that great rooms of memory were being opened to me. Great files were being rolled out of my unconscious. And I actually began by getting back a lot of information about a boy's summer camp in the Smoky Mountains where I had worked as a camp counselor when I was 20 years old. And in fact sat down fairly quickly and wrote a novel based on some of my experiences that summer, the summer of 1953. It was only after I'd done that that the number of family memories and memories of my own childhood that had begun also pouring in really convinced me that perhaps it was time to start writing down some of those memories. And as I began writing them, not really planning to write a book, each memory that I got seemed to bring forward even more memories. It was like sort of pulling on what turned out to be a fairly endless string.
Now, friends had urged you after your spinal cancer to sit down and write a memoir, and you resisted that for a long time. Why?
Well, I think the main reason was simply that I knew what they were saying was, you're dying, get it down in time. And since I was working very hard on not dying, on not obeying my doctors and those people who obviously felt that my time was extremely limited, I was concentrating very much on myself and my adversary, which was spinal cancer, and I wasn't about to cooperate to the extent of sort of making my last will and testament by laying out the story of my life.
So when you decided to write the memoir, did you just not see it in those terms?
Well, I was well past. I had long outlived my prognosis and felt very strong and very full of energy, as I still do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt it was safe then to proceed, since I didn't suspect that it was going to be my last act above ground.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the experience of reliving your childhood. You make a very interesting observation, which is that even, a normal childhood is filled with all kinds of terrors. And you have a paragraph about that I'd like for you to read.
None of the fears I met at 51, when my life was broken like a stick across some broad but unseen knee, and the fractured pieces were flung back into my numb hands to use as I could. No terror matched the childhood threats I've described. My guess is a great many people will grant the same, as the trials of age fly up in their road like actual demons whose harmless shadows we met and partly tamed in Halloween games. Any soul that endures a normal childhood, not to speak of the all but unthinkable innocence who lasts through torture at the hands of adults or disease or God, is made of strong stuff, a thing worth trusting thereafter in the dark.
What were the worst terrors of your childhood when you looked back on them?
Well, I think the worst terror of my early childhood, say from age 4 and 5 on into perhaps 8 or 9 was really the great fear that my father, who had been an alcoholic but was in recovery from the time I was about 3 years old, my greatest fear was that he would return to drinking. I had never seen him in any state of inebriation, and had certainly never seen him actually take a drink. But I learned accidentally fairly early in my life that indeed he had had very serious problems, and being the very watchful child I was and being the only child in the house until I was 8, I was pretty concerned to be a kind of little temperance officer on the premises.
How would you do that?
Oh, monitoring very carefully what I saw when friends of my parents came over and brought bottles, hanging out as long as they'd let me, and then when time came to put little Reynolds to bed, feeling fairly miserable that I could no longer be in there, being quite certain that he wasn't drinking. Little did I know that he was very strong in his resolve, and that apparently he felt no temptation to drink in the presence of these cheerful friends after football games. But I didn't know that. Children know very little about the possibility of change in human life. They assume that any condition is permanent and cannot be altered, it seems to me. It's one of the desperate things about childhood.
Yeah, you make that point in your memoir, and I think it's a really interesting one. You say that you even wish that one of your trustworthy aunts would have tried to explain to you that time changes things and that you're not stuck in this condition, whatever the condition is at the moment, for the rest of your life. But I have to say that I think I had parents who tried to convince me of that, and it didn't work.
I think you're still right. I feel stuck. I think I even say that perhaps it wouldn't have worked. But children simply don't have the experience of time. They don't have any sense of perspective, and understandably they feel absolutely trapped. What they are feeling at this moment is presumably what they're going to be feeling for the rest of their lives. I had enormously happy times in my childhood, and I suppose on balance, if I look back, I would have to say that I had a serene and lovely childhood, but that's not to cover the fact that there were very bad moments indeed, and all of them I've at least tried to be honest about in this memoir.
Would you describe the vision that you had when you had your spinal tumor, and this was a cancerous tumor that went a good deal down the length of your spine? Why don't you describe what your medical condition was then and what the vision was?
Well, in the summer of 1984, it was discovered. The very large tumor had produced almost no symptoms, and then suddenly it began producing symptoms with great difficulty in walking and using my legs. And then it was discovered that I had, beginning at my hairline in the back, and I have a fairly normal man's haircut, so I don't have the locks of Samson. But beginning at the sort of more or less end of my hairline and down for about 11 inches inside my vertebrae, in the spinal cord itself, there was this very malignant tumor, which had been in there no doubt a great many years. In fact, several of my doctors thought I had probably been born with it, that it was probably congenital, and that it just had developed very, very, very slowly. At that point in American surgical history, and amongst the neurosurgeons of Duke Hospital, it was impossible to remove. They got in about 10% of it and then had to surrender me to the tender mercies of radiation. I had 5 weeks of radiation. I was warned that if I went with the maximum dosage of radiation, which they hoped to give me, that I stood a very good chance of losing the use of my legs. And sure enough, within 3 weeks after the end of the radiation, I had become paraplegic and have remained so ever since. However, a couple of days, I believe that's correct, certainly not a week, but with 2 or 3 days before the radiation was to begin, I was sitting up in bed waiting for a friend to come from another bedroom in the house and get me up and help me get dressed. And I just saw myself lying down by a very large lake, which I realized was what in the New Testament is called the Sea of Galilee. And I realized that I was dressed in sort of modern American men's clothes, and all the men who were lying down around me were dressed in sort of Jesus suits. And all of a sudden, one of them got up and came toward me and silently sort of beckoned me to follow him into the water. And I did, and we wound up in this lake up to our waists, and in the way that one often can in visions that I've read about. I could see myself as though I were in a sort of mini helicopter looming over the scene, and I could see my back, and I could see the very bad scar that was down my back, and the sort of tattooed radiation lines that had been drawn around that scar for the to guide the radiation when that was to begin. And this man, whom I realized was Jesus, was just simply picking up handfuls of water out of the lake and pouring them over that scar. And he said, the only thing he said initially was, your sins are forgiven. And I thought, well, that's the last thing I want to hear right now. And I said, am I also healed? And as though I had extracted it from him, perhaps rather against his will, he said, that too. And he turned and walked away. And that was the end of the vision.
When the vision ended, did you test yourself to see, am I healed? And, you know, did you see that as something like literal and medical or something more metaphoric?
I didn't know what I thought it meant. And I didn't know how seriously I could take it. And then, you know, the radiation began 2 or 3 days later, and rather quickly I began to use the use of my legs. I was already – my legs were in bad shape already after the surgery. And I began rapidly to lose the use of those legs and was paraplegic in a matter within 3 weeks after the end of the radiation. So why did I go through with the radiation if I believed that Jesus had healed me in some sense with this vision? I don't know. I had a fascinating letter from a woman in Mexico shortly after I published the book about that moment that included that moment. And she said, why did you go ahead with the radiation, which may have left you crippled, when you had in fact already been healed? And the answer is, I don't know why I did. I did it because all my doctors were telling me to do it. But meanwhile, at that time, one of my most respected physicians told my brother that I probably had 18 months to live at best. I wouldn't let them give me a prognosis because I knew if they said, you know, X number of weeks or months or years, I'd probably, you know, outrace the prognosis just to prove I could. And that was 22 years ago.
So when you had this vision, did you tell your doctors?
No, I didn't tell my doctor. And I don't know whom I told first. Interestingly, again, shortly after I published the book about those cancer years and mentioned that vision, I got a wonderful letter from a very old Jesuit in India. And he had read the book, and he said that he trusted that I knew I had had a great privilege. And he said, you have seen our Lord, and perhaps you would tell me, he said, how he looks. And I could only answer in a way that might have sounded scoffing or comical. I said, Father, he looks just like his pictures. Because how would I have recognized him if he'd been 7 feet tall and wearing a Harris tweed jacket and corduroy trousers or something? No, he looked like Jesus in Renaissance paintings of Jesus. He was standing out there. He had no shirt on, nor did I. We were in some sort of clothes that people would wear to wade out into a lake. And he was sort of putting these handfuls of water down my spine.
How do you explain that you have this vision of being healed when you still have like 2 more years of like really serious like pain and cancer crisis and a whole lifetime following that? A whole remaining lifetime of being paraplegic. I mean, that wouldn't fit the classic definition of being healed.
It wouldn't, no. And I found out that if I happened to be in Lourdes, France, that it would not be accepted as a miraculous healing. You know, Flannery O'Connor went to Lourdes, which I've always thought was very moving, but she was not healed there. She died shortly after going there of lupus, though despite her extreme devout Catholicism. I don't explain it. I just know that it happened, and I know that, what is it? I think there's an old hymn, God works in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform. That's all I could say. And I don't, and I don't go out on platforms presenting myself as a visionary, though I have indeed mentioned it in two or three books.
Do you think that life would be too unbearable without faith?
You know, I've never thought of that, because I never came really close to losing it. I've realized that I was being almost tortured by what I thought was God, if not tortured, but I just went on waiting. I mean, I once, when I was very, very, in very bad shape with this cancer in the summer of 84, as paraplegia was really becoming inevitable for me, and I remember lying in bed one night and just saying, you know, to the dark, how much more of this is there going to be? How much farther is this going to go? And I think if you'd been there with your tape recorder, you wouldn't have heard it. Or with your own ears, you wouldn't have heard it. But I distinctly heard something that sounded like someone else's voice, a man's voice. It just said more, and there was more. And I still think that, to some extent, that was probably a communication of some sort. But that's it. I mean, I'm not weird. I'm not religiously weird. And I'm about the most unmissionary soul you could possibly find, which is probably a contradiction of saying that I'm religious, but I don't feel that I have any right whatever to go out into the world and try to change the morals and the ethics of anyone else, unless that person is trying to hurt me.
You write in your book, I am one of the least puritanical souls presently alive on the planet. And now I will ask you to tell me something that will prove that.
Ooh. I'm a great believer in joy. Joy I take to have as its absolute first condition that it not seriously harm another living creature.
And is that what makes you the least puritanical soul alive on
the planet? Well, yeah. Don't we think of Puritans as having been sort of joyless souls wandering around Salem, Mass. Or Plymouth, Mass. In their gray suits with large Bibles in their hands? I also grew up in the South, which, despite the fact that it's so frequently thought of as the Bible Belt, has got an awful lot of joy loose in it, loose and tied down in the South. And my families, both my families, the Prices, my father's family, and the Rodwells, my mother's family, were much given to laughter and tale-telling and playing lovely pranks on one another. So they were good to each other in generating fun and joy around them. And I think, yeah.
When you lost the use of your legs about 20 years ago,
yeah,
as a result of the spinal cancer and the procedures that you had to kill the cancer,
right.
Did you have to find alternate ways of experiencing joy?
I did. I'm going to say one thing, and I'd like not to go beyond that, which is one thing I had to give up immediately was my sexual life, because paraplegia takes care of that rather rapidly. But, yeah, I had to invent all sorts of other forms. I mean, I had to figure out how to, move across a room. I had to learn how to work a wheelchair. I had to learn how to, get in and out of the bathroom, in and out of the shower. Just all those extremely practical things, and then on up and down from there. And I said in that book I wrote about my cancer, which is called A Whole New Life, I said, one of the most valuable things that someone could have done for me once I got past the initial shock of the surgery and the radiation would have been if someone whom I could have trusted would have walked in my room and simply said, Reynolds Price is dead, who do you propose to be tomorrow? Because Reynolds Price was dead. The person I'd thought of as me in so many ways. Obviously, huge parts of me survived. Thank God. But I had to reinvent, I don't know what, more than 60% of the way Reynolds Price lived and did things.
Can I ask what are some of the things that give you the most joy now?
Being with people I love is primary, but that's hardly new to Reynolds Price and any of his avatars. I don't think there's anything new. It's all the old things, music, theater, being with friends, teaching. I mean, obviously I wouldn't have taught for 48 years if I hadn't loved it. I could certainly have, you know, made donuts if it had come to that. But loved ones, friends and loved ones above all. And thank God I've got a good supply.
Just one more thing. If I'm remembering correctly, in your book, you say that you think maybe you were selected, chosen, I'm forgetting the word that you use, but kind of singled out for this affliction that you had.
That may be the case, because I've often asked myself, if I could now, knowing what I know about the last 22 years, if I could be presented with a sort of magical retroactive pair of buttons which would say bypass paraplegia or continue with, I feel most of the time I'd press the continue with button, because as difficult as it's been and as painful as it's been tremendously interesting. Maybe that means I'm the largest masochist you'll ever talk to. But I think I'd press the continue with button.
Writer Reynolds Price speaking with Terry Gross in 2006. Price died yesterday. He was 77. In another loss to the literary world this week, writer and critic Wilfred Sheed died Wednesday in Massachusetts at the age of 80. Sheed's gentle wit infused his novels, reviews, memoirs, and nonfiction over a writing career that spanned a half a century. Sheed grew up around writers and intellectuals. He was born in London to parents who'd founded the Catholic publishing house Sheed and Ward. The family emigrated to the U.S., where Sheed was an enthusiastic athlete until he contracted polio at age 14. He also struggled with alcoholism and drug addiction. Sheed's work ranged from essays and reviews in The New Yorker and other publications to novels and memoirs to nonfiction, including a biography of Clare Booth Luce and his last book, A History of American Popular Music, published in 2007. Terry spoke to Wilfred Sheed in 1988.
Now, you are both a novelist and critic, so you have lived and worked in two different, also often conflicting worlds. You write that as an author, receiving a bad review is like being spit on by a complete stranger in Times Square. Has that feeling ever held you back from writing a bad review?
It finally held me back from writing any reviews at all. I do very, very few these days. At least of living people, because, just to be crass about it, I don't need any more enemies. As a novelist, you really don't need any more than the course of life is going to send you. But also, yes, on humane grounds, I think that you lose the killer instinct as you go along. I think that criticism can be a blood sport, and really to be indulged by the young. As you get old, you imagine that perhaps the person is ill, or you know, you imagine all the situations that have happened to yourself at one time or another, and you really can't go on giving it. You know how much it hurts.
You don't think that criticism plays a higher function than just panning a new book or dishing the writer?
Yes, I suppose when I talk about panning, I really never did enjoy it. People seem to assume that this is the part of their work that critics really enjoy the most. And I suppose, you know, one can indulge oneself in this. There are probably more rich, hostile words in the language than nice ones. But I have really enjoyed writing favorable reviews. And actually, I think criticism itself goes way beyond praise and blame. Criticism, as opposed to reviewing, is that you assume that the reader is familiar with the work of art or will make himself so, and then you can talk. This is the talk of people who have gone beyond the question of whether it's good or bad and now just want to talk about the thing itself. And that kind of criticism I would still like to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were very athletic when you were growing up, and you didn't much like books. That changed, I think, when you got polio when you were, I believe, 14 years old. Were you surprised when you were ill to find that you actually enjoyed reading?
No, I had done a little furtive reading before that.
Furtive, huh?
Yes. It was the difference between...
You were hiding it from friends or parents?
Oh, from friends. Mm-hmm. No, for parents, I would I would strut it. But the sort of friends I knew were not readers themselves. And they, if you can be macho at the age of 10, that's what we were, by golly. And you weren't going to read more than the other fellow. Although, of course, there were certain approved texts. Comic books were perfectly all right.
Did polio have any lasting physical effects on you?
Yes, I still have a limp, and I was a sort of borderline case. I was still able to swing a golf club, although not walk the length of a golf course, things of that sort. So I got a bit of everything. I had an absolutely wicked serve at ping pong. And just enough, once again, as Warm Springs had finessed the trauma of the thing, and being able to take part in things finessed the rest. So I can't say that at any stage that this was a terrible, shattering experience.
You first came to America when you were 9. You returned to England to go to prep school, then returned back to the United States. When did you stop feeling like a foreigner in America?
That took a long time. I suppose, actually, when I had children. And my children weren't foreigners. And then I knew that I couldn't very well be myself. Also, of course, people stop noticing an English accent, and then it really takes...
You don't have a very strong one.
Actually, I have a stronger one electronically than I have in real life, I believe. Because my son first heard me on radio when he was very small and said, "Well, you're English," which had never occurred to him before.
When you were young and had just come to America from England, was it considered a feat to have a British accent?
With the guys I ran with, yes, it was definitely a feat. These were tended to be Irish Catholics, and I've had to make my peace with them. And I was not only stuck with a plummy Cockney accent, but also a ridiculous first name.
Oh, Wilfred. Did you try to shorten it to Fred or Willie?
I managed to impose Bill on as many people as I could, but then my parents would come around and say, "Oh, Wilfred," and then I'd have to start all over again.
Did you try for a Brooklyn or New York accent when you were young?
Well, I wanted an American one. I myself thought English sounded very silly. I know many people would go out of their way to speak with an English accent. Well, I went out of my way not to. It was really a safety device. It was a life-saving one as far as I was concerned.
What about your writing? Do you think of your writing as having more of an American or of an English accent?
Well, I'd gone back to England and was out of sorts about the whole thing. And then I read The Thurber Carnival, and I thought, that's what I want to write like. And so I would credit Thurber with making me want to write American rather than English.
Mm-hmm.
But then, naturally, the other stuff comes in the back door, and I will find I'm using English locutions and an English vocabulary. But it's on an American spine, or at least I trust so.
Writer Wilfred Sheed speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. Sheed died Wednesday. He was 80. Corin Tucker was one of the founding members of Sleater-Kinney, a 1990s trio that spearheaded the Riot Girl movement in American post-punk. In recent years, Tucker has receded from the music business to focus on being a mom. But now she's back with a new group, the Corin Tucker Band, and an album called 1,000 Years. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Corin Tucker's strong, surging voice was one of the most recognizable sounds of 90s rock. It cut through the careful clatter of Sleater-Kinney as a combination yell, wail, and curse. It was a voice that served as its own manifesto, regardless of the lyrics she might be singing. On 1,000 Years and as leader of the Corin Tucker Band, her singing is frequently more subdued and intimate.
Happen one lazy afternoon, with kids at play and mom at school, late made dinner and snatched up news, fun stride up, my job cut loose, beans are all we have for you.
That's Thrift Store Coats, describing a closed-in world with the minimalist details of a Raymond Carver short story. On It's Always Summer, the weather reflects the narrator's mood, and technology both helps and adds to the discomfort. She's feeling cold in every sense, talking to a guy who's in a distant climate where it's always summer. Meanwhile, she feels as though their conversations last 10 years long, and she's always moving the thermostat up another few degrees, as if that might also rekindle the heat in their relationship.
The hotel bar stays open long. The party noise is audible. I'm on a phone call 10 years long. There's our connection breaking down. It's always summer where you are. It's always something.
One of the most striking songs on 1,000 Years, the one that connects to the themes Tucker used to wrestle with most often as part of Sleater-Kinney, is Doubt. It takes the form of a flying wedge of slashing rock, the guitars and drums creating a headlong clamor that Tucker has to yell over. It wouldn't seem a setting for intimacy, but it is. Tucker is arguing with herself in public, seeming to refer to the relative quietness of the rest of the album when she says she's trying to, quote, break up with the boogie, turning down the sound, trying to live without it. Yet, she concedes, it's when she's lost in the chaos of rock music that she loses her nagging doubts. This song, Doubt, says that losing herself in music is the deepest drug, the tallest joy. I forget myself for a while. Doubt is both sad and exhilarating. Thousand Years is an album made by a woman who's put aside the excesses of her youth and occasionally misses them. She may be content with the domestic life she's created for herself, but I think it's significant that two songs, It's Always Summer and another rocker called Riley, make phone conversations most prominent. It's as though the songwriter is acknowledging she's no longer living the rock and roll life, and one of her primary means of contact with her previous life is conversations with people she used to hang out with, love, or argue with.
Heard the phone ring, it's been a while since I heard from you since we hung out. Say hello, dear, how you been? Then you drop the bomb, baby. Fill me in. We're still around. It's a long road. We're going down. Right.
of heavy, often beautiful melancholy hangs over 1,000 years. The songs drop hints of poignant discontent. A line about the zombie wearing mommy's clothes here, a line about I'm just a shadow of what I used to be there. There are references to the tough economy and hitting rock bottom. Taken together, however, the album is the opposite of a downer. Corin Tucker knows how to transmute melancholy into energy, a stubborn belief that what can feel like a trap can also turn into a map to freedom.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed 1,000 Years, the debut album by the Corin Tucker Band. In the hit film Black Swan, Natalie Portman plays a virginal ballerina told by her director to have sex to get in touch with her deeper, darker emotions. In the new romantic comedy No Strings Attached, Portman plays a medical resident who wants the sex, here with actor Ashton Kutcher, but not the emotions that come with it. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
I've heard the perpetrators of No Strings Attached pat themselves on the back for making a comedy that's edgy. Yet I've seen movies from the early 30s, before the restrictive codes, that had less old-fashioned ideas about casual sex. The gimmick here is that Natalie Portman's brainy medical resident Emma is, quote, allergic to serious relationships and wants a special guy friend for regular trysts. Just the job, she thinks, for her old summer camp acquaintance Adam, a down-to-earth TV production assistant played by the tall and rangy Ashton Kutcher. The scheme is hatched in her bedroom after a spontaneous and highly satisfying quickie.
You know, I don't want to freak you out, but I'd love to hang out with you in the daytime sometime.
It's not really possible. I have no time. I work 80 hours a week doing 36-hour shifts. What I need is someone who's going to be in my bed at 2 a.m. who I don't have to lie to or eat breakfast with.
I hate breakfast.
Do you want to do this?
Do what?
Use each other for sex at all hours of the day and night. Nothing else.
Yeah, I could do that.
Adam says it would be fun, but it's instantly clear that he wants flowers and romance and a relationship, which drives Emma crazy for the very good reason that, well, actually, there is no logical reason apart from the script's high concept. Adam is handsome, funny, kind, talented, and even rich. His dad, played by Kevin Kline, is a famous actor. When they meet 5 years before the main action, he wears a backwards cap and talks like a stoner dude. But by the time he and Emma get together, there's no indication they're intellectually mismatched. Although the snappy script is by a woman, Elizabeth Merriweather, and has a supposedly feminist veneer, it's the brusque female professional and the clingy male bimbo, No Strings Attached never makes the case for Emma's point of view. It's almost a feminist backlash movie. And it didn't have to be. There are plenty of reasons for brilliant young women, especially with the stress of a medical career, to approach time and emotion-consuming relationships warily. But Emma just seems psychologically off. Natalie Portman plays her high-strung and brittle, careering from chill cerebral detachment to messy, babbling emotional spew. Portman is okay, but she never fills the character in. The why of Emma's peculiar allergy goes unanswered, and so you never like her. Portman gets no help from Ivan Reitman, the heavy-handed director. Reitman was lucky enough in the 70s to fall in with a bunch of geniuses affiliated with the National Lampoon, with whom he made Meatballs and Ghostbusters. Lately, he's paved the way for his son, Jason, who won a slew of Oscar nominations for supposedly edgy comedies like Juno and Up in the Air. No Strings Attached is like the father trying to get in on the son's action, which is what Adam's father actually does in the movie. The elder Reitman, though, has none of his son's feel for the zeitgeist, and the commercial scaffolding shows. There's the wisecracking gay guy, the wisecracking black guy, and the bubbly blonde friend of the heroine, played by indie pinup girl Greta Gerwig, who, as Emma's roommate, has little to do except smirk sympathetically. The movie is so calculated, I felt that if the camera pulled back a foot from the bed while the actors pretended to make love, Their agents would be standing there glowing like proud parents. We should be grateful there is sex, though, which is more than you can say for something like the 2003 Hollywood romantic comedy How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, which was founded on the premise that even the most beautiful woman could drive a man off by sleeping with him instantly and then getting clingy, except the studio allegedly balked at the sex part for fear the audience would think she's a slut, so the whole premise made no sense. No Strings Attached is corny and contrived, and conservative, and that in the end it argues that the no-strings-attached plan can't work. But at least Emma isn't a slut for wanting the same kind of pleasure that guys do. She's just portrayed as kind of crazy.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.